This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we talk with a journalist who reported on the war in Kosovo. He was one of just a handful of reporters who went into Kosovo as the NATO bombardment of Serbia began in March of 1999. Matthew McAllister will tell us what he learned about the war from those who lived through it, both its victims and its perpetrators. He is a correspondent for Newsday and the author of Beyond the Mountains of the Damned, The War Inside Kosovo. The book tells the story of the family of Isa Bala. The Bala family were Kosovar Albanians who remained in their home as thousands of others fled. Isa Bala survived, but his family was killed. One of those responsible had been a neighbor, Nebojsa Minic. Minic is a Serbian. He'd been in trouble with the police since he was a boy. A veteran of the war in Bosnia, he called himself Death. Murder, rape, and robbery were sport for him. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. Your questions and comments are welcome. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Matthew McAllister is the Middle East correspondent for Newsday. He shared a Pulitzer Prize in 1997 for his coverage of the crash of TWA Flight 800. His book, Beyond the Mountains of the Damned, is published by New York University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Matthew McAllister, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. It's a pleasure.
Let's start with some background. Kosovo is part of Yugoslavia, and the majority of Kosovars are ethnic Albanians. What else would be helpful to know about Kosovo at the outset of our discussion?
It would be helpful to know that the minority who are and were Serbs, I say were because there are very few left now since the war in 1999, felt beleaguered by the majority, felt set upon in the late 1980s as the Soviet Union was crumbling and as the world seemed to be changing. And Milosevic, Slobodan Milosevic, exploited that anxiety and insecurity of the minority Serbs inside Kosovo. So they were tense and the tension was building. Shortly after that, the autonomy that Kosovo had was taken away by Milosevic in Belgrade, and the province was ruled by Belgrade directly. And that gave the minority Serbs in Kosovo enormous power over the majority of the Albanians there.
Hmm. And what Belgrade wanted was more than political control, though, right?
Yeah, ultimately, what Belgrade wanted was the wealth of Kosovo. They wanted to control Kosovo, and when 1999 came about, it was just a few hours before Serbian paramilitaries were moving through Kosovar towns and finding immediately the richest people who lived there and stealing from them first. And so they'd been planning for a while to take advantage of if the war in Kosovo did happen, which it did, to take advantage of that situation for their own financial gain.
Hmm. The NATO bombardment began late in the winter of 99 and continued into early summer. Would you summarize for us the chain of events that led to the bombardment?
Yeah, very simply, the 10 years had gone by that the Serbs had been controlling Kosovo, and it was kind of an apartheid state. And after about 7 years of nonviolent protest by the Albanians against Serb rule, some Albanians took to the gun and formed a group called the Kosovo Liberation Army, who were variously called a terrorist group or freedom fighters, as often happens when groups start like that. Clamping down on them, the Serbian police forces, who are not police as we know them, they're much more of a military organization, clamped down on them very harshly. Part of that was the killing of civilians. That happened several times, very, very sort of well-publicized places. That led to the United States in particular being very anxious about the possible fate of more Albanian civilians. And so after failed peace talks in early 1999, the bombardment started because it was felt within the administration that this was the only way that Milosevic would understand the seriousness of the West's concern about the plight of the Albanians.
Mm. What are your thoughts about the NATO campaign?
My thoughts really were a sort of twofold. One is that it was, much as I dislike war, it was perhaps the most just moral campaign that has been waged for quite a long time in the West. But I think one thing that was unforgivable was President Clinton's early refusal to even acknowledge the possibility that ground troops could be sent in. You don't have to be a military strategist to know that if you tell your enemy that you're not going to use one of the fundamental weapons of war, he's not going to be as worried as he would be otherwise. And so just to threaten, as President Clinton did, the air campaign as the only tool of war, even though it was ultimately successful, I think was a mistake. And it was a mistake because more Albanian lives could have been saved merely perhaps by the threat. The troops might not have had to have been used.
Mm. I can remember hearing statements, there will be no ground war, and of course there very definitely was a war on the ground in Kosovo.
There was. It was a war that primarily went unseen because we mainly watched it from the margins, from refugee camps and from cameras attached to missiles that were guided into Serbian military buildings. But there was a war, and it was a war by paramilitary organizations controlled by the Serbian state, the Yugoslav state as well, against civilians as well as against the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army.
You write in the introduction to the book, while the war was unfolding, the world didn't see it. Why didn't we see it? Why were there so few reporters in Kosovo?
We didn't see it because Milosevic wouldn't let us in. The only way you could go in was really with the rubber stamp from Belgrade. And so even though some reporters did that and got good stories and important stories, there was no freedom. None of us had the freedom that we would like. Like I live in Israel, and we have freedom to cover the West Bank and Gaza and Israel without any restraint. In Kosovo, we couldn't go anywhere, and to go in was a risky thing.
There have been complaints about access for journalists trying to tell the story of Desert Storm, and now complaints about access in Afghanistan. Any thoughts on the problems that journalists are having these days trying to tell the story in places where war is being waged?
Yeah, I think it's an age-old problem. The Desert Storm situation was the American government. In Afghanistan, where I was for the war, the problem was that you couldn't cross into Taliban-controlled areas because they would just kill you or at the very least detain you. It would be nice to be seen as a journalist by every warring faction in the world as impartial, which we try to be, but we're not. We're seen very much as citizens of the countries from which we're from, and so the Taliban, the Serbs, the Iraqis, while being bombed, are not particularly fond of having people they would very quickly construe as spies wandering around their territory, and that restricts the access enormously.
Mm. I don't want to spend too much time on this issue because I really want to talk about Kosovo, because the book that you've written is really fine. But I do want to talk a little bit more about the situation of reporters, and because it is so important that we know what's going on in the world. Maureen Dowd wrote a column that appeared yesterday in the New York Times, and the column focused on the lack of access reporters have had to the war in Afghanistan, while, to quote her, Pentagon officials are rolling out the camouflage carpet now for ABC's entertainment division. Here she's referring to plans for a Pentagon-sanctioned docudrama miniseries on the war, on terrorism, and there's apparently a VH1 show in the works as well.
Yeah, I find that troubling as well, like Maureen Dowd. You know, we're reporters, and I'm a little surprised that ABC is doing that. It is frustrating, and we have, and also Donald Rumsfeld's suggestion that that the government might deliberately start lying, or that the Pentagon might start lying, although that's been retracted to some degree. It's frustrating, and we have to, as journalists, push against it and keep reporting and keep trying to nuzzle in there where they don't want us. And in a sense, that's a challenge, and it's one of the things that makes the job interesting and exciting. But the other aspect of it is, it's not just the government's role in this, and that is that it's simply dangerous in many of these places, and you cannot go there without endangering your life or being shot by the enemy of the United States or the NATO powers.
When you went into Kosovo, the NATO bombing was just underway, just a couple of days old, I guess. Was there ever any question about going in?
Yeah. My editors and I discussed it at length, and initially my foreign editor was, as he was reminding me the other day, said, don't do it. But we talked about it more, and I felt that my contacts were reliable enough. It's always a risk to some degree, but that we should, you know, I should proceed. And so I did. And I also felt that, you know, after about 2 weeks, and I mentioned this in the book, after about 2 weeks, I think the TV viewers and newspaper readers started to slightly tune out and see the same old images from refugee camps, people coming along dusty roads looking miserable. And I suspect started to think, well, how long is this going to go on for? When's the next show on? And I think it's a reporter's duty to try and retain the interest of people in what's going on in the world, and especially in a war like Kosovo, where so many hundreds of thousands of people are being brutalized or ejected from their homes in such a way as happened in Kosovo. I mean, it was an unusually, to me, unusually morally clear war. It wasn't as murky as many of the conflicts that we get involved with or that just happen around the world.
Mm. In spite of the fact that so many civilians were killed.
Yeah. By NATO, you mean?
NATO and by the Serbs on the ground.
Well, it was the moral clarity to me came because there were so many civilians being killed, and that hundreds, thousands of Bosnian civilians and Croatians had also been killed by Serb forces in the 1990s. And if we hadn't learned our lesson already, you know, then I can't imagine, but at the time of the Kosovo War, I can't imagine what it would take. Srebrenica happened, and 7,000 people, civilians, were massacred. And so I think it was important not to let that happen again.
Hmm. Yeah, we weren't willing to risk losing a NATO soldier on the ground.
That's right, and we didn't. Not a single NATO soldier died in combat in the Kosovo War.
How much time have you spent in Kosovo?
I spent the whole war lasted 78 days, and then I went back for a month or two after that, and then I was again there at the end of 2000.
And how did you decide to begin your storytelling in Pech?
Pech, because it was the place that I covered. It was the place where all the refugees were coming from. I was in Montenegro for most of the war, and all the people I spoke to came from this town, and I began to, even though I'd never been there, get an incredibly clear mental image. I knew where bridges were across rivers and where sports halls were, schools were, and people's houses were, and what the neighborhoods were called. And the only the town across the mountains of the damned, that's in the title of the book, was Pec from Montenegro. So when I crossed those mountains, I was going towards Pec.
Those mountains, they really are. That's the translation of their name.
Yeah,
isn't it?
I'm being slightly liberal with it. The more accurate translation would be the damned mountains or the accursed mountains. But I've been assured by Albanian linguists that the mountains of the damned is perfectly okay.
Isn't it interesting that in this part of the world, not only is there a different name for everything, there's two different names for everything.
Yeah, I mean, Pec, which is the name that I use throughout the course of my book, is not what it's called these days by the people who live there. It's called Peja, which is the Albanian name. And there is now, apart from a few Serbs, heavily protected in the Serbian Orthodox Patriarchate just outside of Pec, there is now not a single Serb living in Pec, which is a town of about 85,000 people. And prior to the war, there were a lot.
So today it's called Peja, which is the Albanian word for the city. But I want to get here to introducing, having you introduce us to Isabala. When he spoke to you, he called the city Pec, right?
Well, he called it Peja. Just for the sake of consistency, in my book, I called it Pec. And I called it Pec purely because that was the first name I heard given to it, and I choose not to go with play the verbal game of whoever's in the political ascendancy at the time. I mean, I suppose I should call it Peja because that's how people call it, but I think if I do that, then I'm saying, oh, well, this is an Albanian town and Serbs have no right to live there, whereas in fact Serbs have lived there for a long, long time.
Thanks for clearing me up on that because I probably went past that way too quickly. So you're in Pec, and how is it that you met Isabala, and tell us about him and his family.
I had crossed over the mountains, and this was at the end of the war, and it was the third time that I'd crossed over into that region. And I had come into Pec days after, hours after the last Serbian paramilitaries left. Some, in fact, were still around. And I was standing outside a building and where the new KLA commander had installed himself. And someone said to me, oh, you see that man over there? He had a terrible tragedy. His most of his family was killed. And not to sound callous, but a lot of people had lost families at that time. And I was like, oh, well, you know, it's not a story. And then someone said, no, but he lost his family 2 days ago. Now, 2 days ago at that stage meant several days after the peace agreement had been signed. And that meant that Serbian paramilitaries were still killing people. And in this case, standing in front of children and firing their Kalashnikov rifles into them on their living room. Days after the peace agreement had been signed and there was a ceasefire in place, and only hours before the first NATO troops made it into Pec.
And this raises a couple of questions. First of all, why did the family stay in Pec, and why were they safe so long?
Well, in a sense, that's the conundrum of my book. And as I was reporting it, I would stand in Issa's butcher's shop in Pec, and I would ask him, and several times I'd say, so, you know, why did you stay again? And he'd say, well, we stayed because my mother is disabled and we couldn't take her. And I said, but well, you had a car. Oh, well, they stole the car. And when did they steal the car? Oh, it was 2 weeks into the war. So why did you stay those 2 weeks? And the answer would slightly change. And he said, well, I had very good relations with, you know, my Serb neighbors and so I thought we would be fine. And so they stayed, and his wife very, very clearly didn't want to stay and tried at one stage to leave, but he said, no, we'll stay. And they survived. Well, Shall I give away the ending of the book?
Well, it's tough because there is so much between the covers that, in a sense, telling what happened is not giving it away.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I'll leave that up to you.
Yeah. Well, I'll explain then. At the very end of my reporting, you're asking the question of the book, really, and I couldn't work it out myself. And I had about a month left before the deadline of my book. So I went back, and I'd been told that a member of the group who had committed the killing would talk to me. And I went to Montenegro and met with him. And he said, yeah, you know, there was a clear reason, and that is because, you know, he had violated our business, and his brother had as well, and he was an informer. And this is what we do with people who worked for us and who then betray us. Now, I was completely shocked. I'd spent, you know, so much time with this man and who'd suffered the most astonishing tragedy and who is a relatively simple man and a very good man, I think. And here was an acknowledged, self-confessed murderer telling me that, in fact, he was an informer for the Serbian authorities. And I was shocked, and I felt I didn't really know what to do. But the only thing I could do was to report around it. And what had happened was that at one stage, there were two things here. One is that at one stage during the war, Musa, who is Issa's brother, and his family had tried to escape with the help of Serbs and Montenegrins, who turned out to be connected to this paramilitary group. This paramilitary group was making most of its money by secreting Albanians and whisking them out of the country to the safety of Montenegro. And when Musa got caught, he confessed everything in this court case, and thereby exposing to another branch of the Serbian authorities this business scam that basically this gang had going. And so that was the end of that source of revenue for them, and they were furious about it because they knew that the war was going to end soon. They only had 10 days left more to make all the money that they could. And suddenly this, you know, Albanian idiot had sung like a canary. So they were furious about that, and that's the real reason. But what added to the spice of it and the motivation is that the Serbs felt that Musa and Issa Bala had been helpful to them in providing information. Now, I reported around that, and yes, it turned out that even the KLA knew that the Bala brothers had been low-level informers, but they really were low-level. To be an Albanian businessman in Serb-controlled Kosovo meant cooperating to some degree. And Issa, by his own acknowledgement, gave free meat to whichever Serbian policeman came in. And he denied to me that he ever gave information. But from what I understand, he would occasionally just sort of gossip, really, just pass on gossip. And it sounds like a terrible thing, but to survive in Kosovo in those days, he really had to do that. And he's been widely forgiven. I mean, all Albanian businessmen who did such a thing have been. And frankly, you know, the man has suffered the greatest tragedy that anyone ever could of having his children murdered in front of him. And so no one's interested in having any kind of retribution against him.
Matthew McAllister is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Beyond the Mountains of the Damned, The War Inside Kosovo. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your participation in the discussion. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us from Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi. I think it's arguable that I think this is a much more morally complex situation, and I think it's arguable that the intervention, the way it was done, actually dislocated more people and caused more problems than it solved. The question then would is generated is what would you suggest otherwise, and that would involve an intervention much earlier and a more even-handed approach much earlier. And I think there is a bit of hesitancy to intervene on the behalf of Muslims, actually. I think that's part of the dimension. You mentioned Clinton as being sort of a bad actor ruling out ground troops. I think there's also other things that can be said about his role, and I was wondering if you had a chance to assess and listen or read the transcripts that were released recently of Clinton's discussions with Milosevic.
No, I haven't. I'd be very interested in reading them.
It was released by the Croatians, and in this kind of a complex situation, you have to look at the reasons for the action, and one could question how authentic the editing might be, et cetera. But I understand in the last couple of weeks, Croatians released some eavesdropped conversations, and you know, this is when he was the hero of Dayton, basically, or if not the hero, at least the good actor. Victor's justice is kind of a line from, I guess, Chomsky. I mentioned earlier the morally complex aspect of this. His book, like, study about moral humanitarian intervention, I think, is in the title, and how he doesn't believe it's true. But there's an actor who is certainly a bad actor in the situation there, who was with the KLA, like, for instance, Akim Ketu. I hope I'm getting the name sort of close. I don't know Serbo-Croatian, but he was with the KLA. Before that, he was involved with General Maxwell, Ad Max, or the NATO commander of the U.S. fellow in the Krajina. And there are a lot of people say that he was he should be indicted for that, if not in his later role as part of the KLA, where there were attacks on civilians. Those are both cases of, you know, Albanians attacking Serbian civilians. But the fact that there really aren't any of those cases being made in any, there's simply a long list of Serbian criminals, and it's arguably that there were more people involved, but it still looks, and you know, it feeds the resentment of the area of the idea of Victor's justice, the fact that, that no one is being on the other side, and I'm sure you will assert that there are people that were bad actors on the Kosovo.
Very much so. And I mean, there are some efforts being made in Bosnia, Croatia, and even Kosovo itself to arrest people involved. Three former KLA officials were arrested by UN troops in Pristina at the end of January. And Nasser Oric, who is the Bosnian Muslim leader in Srebrenica, of all places, is also being investigated by The Hague for potential war crimes charges. So there are moves afoot to spread it beyond the Serbs. Just going back to, and I agree it's important that that happens, going back to one thing you said about would the NATO bombardment, did that worsen the situation? In my reporting, I spoke with many Serbian paramilitaries. They had been prepared for weeks for this. It was all planned out. Years these lists had been compiled. And while Milosevic's ethnic cleansing campaign may have been opportunistic on one level, it was clearly planned out. And if you look at what happened in Croatia and Bosnia, it was a pattern. And like I said earlier, we shouldn't have been surprised about what happened in Kosovo. And indeed, they were planning it.
Well, having a list and a dossier is one thing, but actually implementing is another thing. And, you know, again, I agree that it was hard to imagine, you know, a strategy at that late date of what to do. You know, it seems that one leaves it to that length and then gives them the pretext to implement what they perhaps were planning, perhaps were hoping to do. And then there's just the dislocation of the civilians that happened too, which I think is in winter in Kosovo is not a small factor. The U.S. and doesn't report this. It's only like a right-wing journal that's doing this material on DynCorp, who are hirees in Bosnia, obviously not directly connected to Kosovo, but it is part of the U.S. action in the region, and they are a seamy lot. They have been accused of trade in women and all sorts of stuff. These are the people that the U.S. is hiring, or the U.N. is hiring at U.S. benefit to stabilize the situation. And I just think there's so much, and not to be a conspiracist, but there's just so much complexity, and it just bothers me when everything is cast as a simple battle between good and evil. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Did you want to follow up with any other comments, Matthew?
I think that it is, the Balkans are an incredibly complex place, and even though Kosovo was, in a sense, the easiest war to grasp intellectually, what I tried to do in the book is to take one family and, in a sense, one or two men, and see the moral complexities on that incredibly microcosmic level. Isabella himself was not completely innocent in some respects, one might say. And so if that's what's happening in the on the street, in people's homes and people's shops, then absolutely I agree with the caller. The ambiguities of the whole region are endless.
Mm. Matthew McAllister is our guest this afternoon. He is the Middle East correspondent for Newsday. He is the author of Beyond the Mountains of the Damned, The War Inside Kosovo. Listeners, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. In the book, you tell readers that in Yugoslavia, the definition of paramilitary took on new meaning. Would you explain and tell us how the paramilitaries operated?
Paramilitaries in the pre-1990s Yugoslavia were really like an auxiliary force. They were the backup. They were like reservists. They were informal. They became the vanguard in Yugoslavia, and in fact, they weren't semi-formal. They were completely formalized by the time Kosovo happened. It had been completely absorbed within the state, and there were no freelance paramilitary groups in Kosovo. They weren't gangs of criminals just running around. It was highly organized, and it came from the Interior Ministry in Belgrade, the orders, and they were primarily police units, and everyone was receiving their orders, and you couldn't just rush around grabbing a TV from someone's house and helping yourself to their money. There were Arkan, the now assassinated paramilitary leader, oversaw much of nearly all of what was going on in terms of looting. It was highly organized.
There was almost a formula, if you will, for how the spoils were to be divided.
Yeah, there was a formula. Each paramilitary could, or police officer, depending on which term you choose, could take about 10%, according to one of Arkan's lieutenants I spoke to. So they would take 10%, but the rest would be sorted out into white goods and furniture and cash and jewelry and shipped off in trucks to Belgrade. And I've been to Arkan's monstrous house in Belgrade, and there's a parking lot next to it, and these trucks would be delivered there all throughout the war. And there had to be reason to this process, or there had to be a process in place, because they knew that this war wasn't going to last that long. They only had, as it turned out, 11 weeks. In that 11 weeks, they basically emptied Kosovo of its valuables and its money. And they did it not haphazardly. They did it by design.
Mm. Your sources for the book include a former high-ranking officer in the regular army, in the Yugoslav army. What did he tell you? What were his thoughts about the paramilitaries?
Well, it's interesting. The army, some elements of the army are really different from the paramilitaries. Even though they're in the police, many paramilitaries are basically recruited criminals. But in the army, there's still that sort of traditional military sense of honor and justice. And he was a very highly educated, polite, relatively cosmopolitan man, and he was disgusted at the role that the army had to play, and the role that the army played to some degree was just acting as logistical backup for the paramilitaries in terms of fixing bridges that had been damaged by NATO bombs, providing vehicles, and providing military support in terms of defending the paramilitaries from the KLA. But the other thing that they did was when the paramilitaries would go into a village and kill and burn houses down and rape and steal, the army would wait back, so they wouldn't be necessarily witnesses to what was going on, but then they would go in afterwards, and it was their job to take the bodies away. And we've heard about in the past year or so trucks full of bodies in the Danube. Well, it was the army that was transporting bodies to burn them and to dump them in rivers and to take away the evidence that Milosevic realized was so easily accessible in Bosnia, and he did his very best to make sure it was not accessible in Kosovo, which is why some people say, well, you know, only the Hague have only found 3,000 odd bodies, but in fact, when you do a sort of count up of how many people are actually missing, it's a lot more than that.
Let's talk about Nebojša Minić, who was a career criminal who found himself in the police force in a paramilitary group. You interviewed a close associate of his. What did this associate, this connection to him, have to say about what this man was like, or is like?
I interviewed several people who know him, and the closest associate admires him greatly. He considers him a great Serbian hero and a man of honor, who paid his men at the end of the war and who's a, you know, incredibly brave fighter and, you know, has not done a thing wrong in his life. Some of his other former employees, if we can call them that, who are also career criminals. I mean, one guy I sat down with, I didn't realize at the time, but my connection, once he'd left, said this guy is wanted by Interpol for several murders around Europe prior to, you know, any wars in Yugoslavia. Can't stand Minić. I mean, he thinks, you know, I remember him saying if I had an axe, I would stick it in his head. Because, and there are various reasons for the enmity that other paramilitaries have for Minić. Primarily, among some of them, is that Minić cheated them out of money. He didn't pay them at the end of the war. But others felt so repelled by Minić's brutality and the brutality of his inner circle that they just want nothing to do with this guy and they never want to see him again. And one guy I remember telling me that he came into a house to arrest someone. That was his story anyway. And Minić's men had been there before, and he found a woman massacred naked on a table with the heads of two of her children on her stomach, on her torso.
That high-ranking connection that you met with and interviewed to Minić, he sounds like he's a really scary guy, too.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, and this is a question that you raise as well in the book, you know, why does someone like that talk to a journalist and let you walk away to write about it?
I think, not to get too sort of primarily, people have a compulsion to tell stories. I mean, I do as a journalist in an odd sense, and here we are conversing, telling little stories. And add that to the Freudian compulsion to tell stories that we're not meant to tell, and you've got these paramilitaries who live with 11 weeks of horror that they went through. And some of them feel bad about it, but even the ones that don't feel guilty about it have this compulsion to actually talk, because they can't really talk to anyone about it. It would be dangerous for them to even tell their families what they did. And along comes a journalist and who they know, because through contacts, they know that they're not going to get into trouble directly by talking to me, because I would never reveal my sources or tell anyone, even the Hague, you know, where these people can be found, if that's the deal that that I've made with these people. And so they talk. I mean, and in the book, I quote a little bit from the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, where the Ancient Mariner, for no apparent reason, has to keep telling his story over and over again, and you know, for the rest of his life. And I think that's true with these people. It makes them feel a little bit better.
Hmm. Minich, at the time the book went to press, was a wealthy man, unindicted. Does that remain the case?
As far as I know, he's unindicted. The Hague won't comment on sealed indictments that they have. But I strongly suspect that he is unindicted at this stage. But, however, I've also heard recently that Hague investigators have been in a village near Pech where Minich was involved, apparently, in another killing. And so they have been investigating that. And so that I'm wondering whether, in fact, Minich may be indicted. The killing in my book is horrific and appalling, but I was told, and I have no idea whether this is true, because again, The Hague declines to comment on these things, that they're not going to push that one further because of the complexities of the case, and that it's seen as a revenge killing for a business deal gone wrong. I would say that murder is murder, especially of children. But so I don't know. I don't know whether he's going to be indicted.
There are fears that the trial underway now in The Hague, Milosevic standing trial on many, many counts of war crimes, 66 counts, there are fears that the trial will fan the flames of ethnic hatred and result in further conflict, that the trial itself is not enough to bring peace or to bring reconciliation to the Balkans. What are your thoughts?
It's an incredibly difficult one. I think that one, from a political and moral perspective, it would be very hard to let someone continue living in freedom when they've committed such crimes as Milosevic has and as Nebojša Minich and any number of people in between them have. On the other hand, when these three Albanian leaders, KLA leaders, whom I mentioned the other day, were arrested in Kosovo, 5,000 Albanians took to the street of Pristina protesting and attacked the UN police. I mean, they were furious. And so there's a great, you know, tribal rallying around of anyone who's arrested or even being interrogated and investigated. But the problem is, these are criminal elements. They're a lot of them were criminals before the war. They were involved in drug smuggling and murder. And throughout the 10 years of the disintegration of Yugoslavia, they bloodied their hands further. And now many of them are in the police at the same time as running smuggling businesses, and smuggling erodes any economy because of the evasion of revenue, tax revenue, and smuggling drugs and women from other countries, from Moldova and so on, into brothels in Pristina, in Belgrade. Everyone has their hands dirty there. And unfortunately, as these countries try to reconstruct themselves and become at one with their neighbors, I strongly feel they have to address the issue of the citizens among them. And if they're going to become Western-style democracies or members of the EU, as I'm sure nearly all of them want to eventually, they can't have these guys strolling around the streets. It's just it's not feasible. Mm.
Matthew McAllister, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. It's been my pleasure.
Take care of yourself.
Thanks.
Matthew McAllister is the Middle East correspondent for Newsday. He was one of just a handful of reporters who went into Kosovo as the NATO bombardment of Serbia began in March of 1999. He's written an account of the war inside Kosovo, the title, Beyond the Mountains of the Damned, The War Inside Kosovo. The book is published by New York University Press.